before we get into the episode, I must discuss with you the viral essay in The Cut about the case for marrying an older man.
Age gaps. Very on brand for us. I'm so glad you said that because I really want to discuss it. I was reading it the other week and just couldn't stop thinking about how much we need to talk about on air.
I've really been stopping myself from WhatsApping you.
So guys, if you haven't seen it, this was a piece by Grazi Sophia Christie in The Cut that has made a lot of noise. It's called The Case for Marrying an Older Man, A Woman's Life is All Work and Little Rest, An Age Gap Relationship Can Help. Essentially, this article argues that women are wisest to maximise their most valuable cultural assets, which are youth and beauty, whether that's right or wrong, and marry older men while they're still very young. 27-year-old Grazi Sophia Christie argues that if you do marry an older man, you're opened up to a life of ease and women are essentially able to get off the very male-defined timeline that has our kind of professional and reproductive lives constantly crashing.
Absolutely.
She argues that, of course, there are kind of concessions that you have to make, but that ultimately it's an incredibly freeing and almost feminist decision to make.
She very much couches her decision as a feminist one, which is why it's become so controversial, but we'll get into that afterwards. So for context, guys, Grazi Sophia Christie was 20. She was a junior at Harvard College, but she says that she went specifically to Harvard Business School, which was quite a way away, every Saturday to work on her Nabokov paper. Guys, the irony is that Nabokov wrote Lolita, which is one of her favourite books. We don't need to spell out why that's interesting. And she would go there because she knew that in one cavernous, well-appointed room sat approximately 50 of the planet's most suitable bachelors. I had high breasts, most of my eggs, plausible deniability when it came to purity, a flush ponytail, a pep in my step that had yet to run out. Apologies to progress, but older men still desired those things.
And then she says, I could not understand why my female classmates did not join me, given their intelligence. Each time I reconsidered the project, it struck me as more reasonable. Why ignore our youth when it amounted to a superpower? Why assume the burdens of womanhood? It's too quick to vanish up a hand, but not its brief benefits at least. I mean, there's a lot to get into there.
There's a lot to get into. So then she met a guy who was 10 years older. It's not quite specified his exact age, but we are led to assume that he was 30 when she was 20.
Exactly. And she'd actually gone to a kind of alumni event, snuck her way in to try and meet an eligible bachelor. Eligible? I always say that wrong.
Eligible.
Yeah, eligible.
I remember everyone making fun of me at GQ for saying it wrong.
Because it's like, can you read him?
Yeah.
And she'd left, saw her future husband come out of the revolving doors outside and jumped out of her Uber. So she kind of knowingly pursued him.
And asked him for a cigarette.
So as Ellie says, Grazi basically argues, I could diligently craft an ideal existence over years and years of sleepless nights in industry, or I could marry it early.
So guys, it's worth saying that she wanted to be a writer. She is now obviously a writer, quite a successful one, I guess, if she's writing in The Cut. But she saw this kind of marrying an older man as a way of becoming a writer full time without worrying about the bills.
See, I didn't get that from it. I more got that she just liked the comfortableness that it was going to provide, because when she was applying for initial jobs after college, she talks about how much he helped her. He helped her write her CV. He hooked her up for coffees. Like, I think she just didn't want to take on the project of being in her 20s on her own. And she found comfort in the fact that this older person with much more lived experience was going to essentially guide her through all those difficult years.
Oh, interesting. So yeah, I got that, but then I also thought that it was because she was desperate to be a writer, and you can't really be a professional writer now without having maybe like 8 years of doing like lots of side hustle, like working as a waitress.
Well, she's disparaging about writing even now, though. She says if she added up all the hours that she spends on it, it would be less than minimum wage. Obviously, it's just she's able to do it because her lifestyle is paid for by her husband.
So she says that ambitious, hungry, he needed someone smart enough to sustain his interests, but flexible enough in her habits to build them around his hours. I could, I do, read myself occupied, make myself free, materialise beside him when he calls for me. In exchange, I left a lucrative but deadening spreadsheet job to write full time without having to live like a writer. I learnt to cook a little and decorate somewhat poorly. So she wanted the kudos of being a writer, but without the life of a writer, which, as we all know, is like quite depressing.
But also, this is the whole classic situation, isn't it, that we've talked about before with the rise of cottagecore and things like that. Like the romanticisation of the writer's life is such an old trope, but yet it still persists.
Because of Carrie Bradshaw. So, I mean, part of me is like, yes, I can understand if you were desperate to be a creative and to write a novel, and you just wanted a means to an end. Not that I think it's a good decision, but I can see why someone would do that. But it doesn't even really feel, as you say, that she was like, she had to write a book or something, and she just needed to like write.
What I got from it is that she had this kind of epiphany, if you like, that as a woman she could utilize her youth and beauty to be able to skip the grind of having to build a life. And she liked the idea of being able to just walk into a fully formed situation. She talks about how when they moved into their flat, he was paying for it, paying all the bills. She would learn the language that he already spoke as a second language. She would holiday in the places that he wanted to. There was something about being led that she liked. I didn't think it was even necessarily about facilitating a professional.
Interesting. Yes, there's a quote, isn't it, where she talks about how he arrived fully formed, bearing the marks of self-improvement from other women. And she was drawn to that, the idea that she basically didn't have to expend any energy making him better. He was already a man when she met him.
She argues that I disliked being called calculating, but I had, like all women, a calculator in my head. I thought it silly to ignore its answers when they pointed to the unfairness for which we really ought to have been preparing. For me, it was more of a fear of women's absolutely diminishing social status as they get older, and so wanting to negate that early. Okay, so the bit of the piece that I particularly found fascinating was where she talks about the kind of opposite of an age gap relationship. So her quote is that when I think of same age, same stage relationships, what I tend to picture is a woman who is doing too much for too little. She talks about how most of her female friends, or most women her age, have partners. These days, girls become partners quite young. A partner is supposed to be the modern answer to the oppression of marriage, the terrible feeling of someone looming over you, head of a household to which you can only ever be the neck. Necks are vulnerable. The problem with a partner, however, is if you're equal in all things, you compromise in all things, and men are too skilled at taking. So she goes on to basically list all of these men that she knows who have become way better because of their female partners. There's the guy who now knows how to floss because his friend taught him, and he kisses girls with fresh breath. A boy married to my friend who doesn't know how to pack his own suitcase. She likes to do it for him. A million boys who know how to touch a woman, who go to therapy because they were pushed, who learn fidelity, boundaries, decency, manners, to use a top sheet and act humanely beneath it, to call their mothers, match colours, bring flowers to funeral, and inhale, exhale in the face of rage. Because some girl they probably don't speak to and never ever will credit, took the time to teach them, all while she was working, raising herself, clawing up the cliff face of adulthood, hauling him up at her own expense.
Preach, honey. I really felt that in Beyonce's lyric, which I think is it in Jolene, her rewriting Jolene, when she's like, I raised that man and I raised his kids. Yeah.
And there is an element of truth to that. While I think her piece is incredibly problematic in a lot of ways, yeah, just to clarify, I definitely think women do take such a pivotal role in helping men navigate their 20s.
100%. And there's still this language that we use. I've heard it so many times among friends, like, oh, she tamed him. Oh, she bettered him. You know, I do think, I never hear that with men.
No, and you never hear a man be like, oh, I'm so worried that I've made her better for her next partner.
Yeah.
They just wouldn't say that, whereas I feel like all women have that fear.
Totally.
They're like, goddamn, is all the training that I've done, all the hard work,
the fucking
gonna be reaped, like, is another woman gonna reap those benefits? Women, I should say, by the way, I'm talking very, like, heterosexual normative terms here, just on the basis of the piece being about heterosexual relationships and also in terms of us being heterosexual women.
Yes, exactly. And I really liked her quote about the fact that she, like, saw all the marks of all his previous women on him, like, he arrived fully formed, yeah, with all the markers of all the girlfriends who had bettered him.
Yeah.
And like each one is quite obvious.
And she was quite pleased not to have to do it.
Yeah.
But she says as well, by opting out of partnership in my 20s, I granted myself a kind of compartmentalized, liberating selfishness that none of my friends have ever managed. So to preface, guys, she clearly has a very, very lovely life, this writer. She lives between London and Miami. She talks about spending her days walking around these beautiful cities, going to art galleries, writing as and when she feels like it. So I think it's really important here. And I think a lot of the criticism of this piece has actually been levied at the fact that this isn't really about age. What she's saying is marry someone rich.
There's a Reddit post that's like, so what this piece does is intellectualize gold digging.
It literally does. That is actually what it does.
Yeah.
But it's quite a seductive piece.
Yeah,
there were elements, as we've just said, where I thought, I see that. I see what you're saying, honey. However, definitely deeply problematic to sacrifice your entire self-identity just to have a slightly easy ride.
Also, again, I just keep going back to the weird, for me, it's just weird that you would choose to do it at 20. Again, maybe at 28, I'd be like, okay, fuck this. Like, men my age, they don't want to settle down. They're still not like ready to like maybe like propose or have kids. And they're not on the same timeline, as you say. Like, they have maybe another 10 years before they need to decide whether they want to have kids. So I can totally see why then you'd want to maybe marry up in terms of age and also maybe financial freedom. But at 20, like those 10 years are really fun.
Yeah, she makes the child rearing piece a massive part of her argument, doesn't she?
Yeah.
And I think that's why this piece perhaps has struck a chord in particular at this time, while there's so much public conversation around tradwives and this return to traditional ideals and women wanting to have a softer life that is more based around the home and there being no shame in that. And yeah, a kickback, I suppose, against modern feminism.
But do we also think that maybe she, because she literally says that Lolita is one of her favourite books.
Yeah, but Lolita's one of my favourite books. However, I find it really strange that she would be so unaware of the obvious parallels in her own life.
Because, yeah, at no point does she kind of really go into the fetishization I think she makes of herself being so young. She clearly revels in the fact that she is this very young woman that kind of makes, like, the way she talks about his friends bitching about her in toilets and stuff, being like, what does he see in her? I think she kind of gets off on that.
Well, she says a symmetry that she recommends is to be young and beautiful in beautiful places. And little things like that that are a bit telling.
I think she should have dug into her Lolita complex
a bit more.
A bit more.
I would have found that fascinating. I did Lolita uni.
Do you know what? I haven't read it. Isn't that wild?
It's so,
I really want
so interesting because it raises so many intellectual kind of issues with literature. So the narrator is the paedophile, essentially. What is he called? Humperdinck? Why is that what I want to
say?
Humbert Humbert.
That's it.
So Humbert Humbert, much like Nick in The Great Gatsby, is a unreliable narrator, which was a really radical thing to do at the time with the form of the novel because he's the paedophile. So, of course, the story is told through his perspective that Lolita was this kind of knowing young woman that wanted to be with him as well. And, you know, he essentially justifies all of his behaviours in a very compelling, seductive way. But, of course, you as the reader are meant to take a more zoomed out view and decide for yourself on the dynamic of the relationship outside of just what he's telling you.
I genuinely need to read it. So it was actually like discounted in W.H. Smith recently, but for some reason I felt embarrassed buying it in the middle of the day. It was like a Wednesday afternoon.
What's so funny about, I've always found about this book and what I found fascinating about studying it is in fact about literature, as I say. So Humbert Humbert seduces the reader with his gift for beautiful language, but nonetheless is capable of rape and murder. And he has this obsession with young girls and a history of mental illness. And there are quite a lot of kind of red flags that Nabokov's put in there, but you almost feel that you're on his side. So it's almost like a psychological experiment, you know, like it's definitely so much deeper than all of the various iterations of Lolita that we see in the public eye are. Like actually the film Lolita, I can't remember even who's in it now, the British one, super problematic because the films do not account for what the book is saying, which is like, this guy is actually a paedophile.
Yes, such a good point. Have you read My Dark Vanessa?
No, I haven't.
I think you'd really enjoy it.
Yeah.
But again, it's kind of similar to this piece. So the paedophile, the teacher who takes advantage of his young student, is obsessed with the book Lolita and gives it to her as a present.
Yeah, it's this very strange thing that when people become very obsessed with the Lolita, they don't get the actual like meta message, which is, do you not understand how problematic you are for swallowing this all hook, line and sinker?
Yeah.
You're being manipulated too.
Yes, 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 exactly.
And yet lots of the cultural adaptations, the public perception of what Lolita is wrong.
Yeah,
like people think Lolita is a knowing young woman who seduces older men. Actually, Lolita is like the victim of a paedophile.
And in My Dark Vanessa, the paedophile teacher kind of absolves himself by thinking that it's his student that's putting moves on him. Again,
okay,
because he's reading into Lolita wrongly. You're right. So yeah, I would personally like her to go into that and psychoanalyze herself a bit more. I mean, I thought it was sad, her saying she wanted to skip adulthood, particularly she calls it a series of exhausting obligations, which I would say is not how I would see adulthood. I mean, now that we've both come out the other side on
your 20s are 30, so fun.
I mean, of course, there's really shit parts, but I would never swap them for the world. They've made me who I am.
Yeah, and also not to constantly psychoanalyze her, but what did happen in her life that she had such trepidation around her 20s? Because I feel like when you're young, you're almost naive and excited about that period. Then again, it's very different. She is 27. I don't know. I think the generation below us, I hate talking about generations in this really separatist kind of way because it feels quite arbitrary. But she did grow up at a slightly different time to us. Maybe the world just looked like a very scary place to her at 20 and that it didn't to us. In a way,
I mean, when I was 20, I was just simply not plugged into the world.
Oh, I was totally oblivious.
Yeah. I remember posting my first Instagram when I came back from my year abroad. So I would have been 21 or something.
Older, because I obviously am a few years older than you. And I definitely didn't post on Instagram until I was like 23.
Right. Yeah. Something. So, God. Also, this may not be factually correct, but I did see on Reddit, my favorite place, that she came from a very rich family and was always going to marry rich, whatever happened.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense.
I also think, again, as someone who is a writer and therefore can't help but look at her kind of ambitions as a writer, skipping your adulthood and therefore all the formative experiences that form your writing and your voice and your sense of self and therefore your writing, that can't make you a good writer.
Oh, yeah.
And also the irony, you're saying you are so happy to meet a man who is fully formed, who has gone through life, who has been like molded by all his many life experiences. But you're saying that you don't have any of that. So what are you? Like, how are you?
You're just a kind of...
You're just blank. How are you? How is that?
Reflection of his own.
Yes.
Enjoyment, experiences, wants, needs, desires.
So there's a really kind of disturbing quote where she says, "He's not my partner. He's my mentor, my lover, and only in certain contexts, my friend. I'll never forget it, how he showed me around our first place like he was introducing me to myself. This is the wine you'll drink, where you'll keep your clothes. We vacation here. This is the other language we'll speak. You'll learn it." And I did.
Yeah, I found that's when, that yeah. very telling. Because, you know, I think, as we've said, this piece is framed as a rational, perhaps even feminist piece of advice, a way for women to kind of quit playing by men's rules and to reject exploitative capitalist demands. Yet, like, actually, she doesn't have a proper sense of self-respect.
Exactly. And a Slate article, a female Slate journalist who kind of wrote a report to this, said, "It's nothing more than a recycling of some of the oldest advice around, for women to mold themselves around more powerful men, to never grow into independent adults, and to find happiness in a state of perpetual pre-adolescent submission and dependence. These are odd choices for an aspiring writer."
I loved that piece. I read that as well, because I think it just really sums up all that is so actually problematic about this. And as she says, it can feel catty to kind of publicly criticize other women's romantic choices, and you open yourself up to accusations of kind of jealousy or pettiness. But the stories that we tell about marriage, love, partnership and gender matter, especially when they're told in major culture shaping magazines. And it's equally as condescending to say that women's choices are off limits for critique, especially when those choices are shared as universal advice, and especially when they neatly dovetail with the resurgent conservative efforts to make women's lives smaller and less independent.
So true. And also one thing I'll say which worried me is that, you know, when she says, like, "I live in an apartment whose rent he pays and that constrains the freedom with which I can ever be angry with him."
Yes. Oh my God, that.
I was like, okay, you're not saying that he's problematic, so let's hope to God that he's a decent man. But you could easily have been shacked up with someone who maybe is violent or like a domestic abuser or emotionally abusive, and you can't leave because he pays your rent, and you're saying that you don't have freedom to be angry with him.
Yeah. What was the quote? That when he feels underappreciated.
When someone says they feel underappreciated, what they really mean is you're in debt to them. Yeah. Exactly. That's it.
I feel like she left some interesting psychological breadcrumbs throughout the piece without even meaning to.
And then what's also interesting is the internet's reaction to it, because this is where I do think people are just so mean and petty. Like, fair enough, find fault with her false feminism and the fact that she's kind of telling young women to sell themselves to the highest bidder. But let's not rip into her. Like, there were so many catty comments about her writing. Like, I even saw on Twitter it was trending, her the way she described her ponytail as flush, and everyone was like, "That is such a weird word to use. No one would, like, only a bad writer would use that word to mean like full or healthy or whatever."
Oh,
and I was like, get grip. Who cares? I always notice this actually. Whenever women write personal essays and they're controversial, they always get ripped for being a bad writer. People love to condescend on, and I've had it before actually as well, when I write, some of the Telegraph commenters, the first thing they'll do is like, creative writing A level, or let's get her back to school. This is a school essay. They love saying that. Why do they love to like just demean the actual art form? It's because they don't know how else to criticize it.
Yeah, it's just like the low hanging fruit.
It's so low hanging fruit. I mean, I actually thought it was fine. One clause I really did almost mini sick at was a pep in my step that had yet to run out.
Oh, that is a bit much. No. But I think what's very strange about the piece though is that one way she posits that she knowingly and purposefully sought out an older man, and in another way it's kind of, oh, we just fell in love and were crazily into each other. It's towing a strange line in that respect.
So I want to know what he thinks of the fact that his wife has written.
Well, he must have approved it, wouldn't he? Like, he doesn't sound like he's the kind of husband that would have allowed this to go out without his say-so first, that's for sure.
Do we think he maybe edited it in a Kanye, Julia Fox manner? That's the thing. Like, if he's paying her rent, she is not really at liberty to write what she wants. But then also, if you were born into quite a wealthy family and a connected family, then don't you think you could have done it on maybe your own terms?
I think she just argues that it would have taken her decades of slog. So she could kind of cut out the hard work and go straight into the lifestyle at the age of 23.
That's true. But if she had rich parents, would it have taken her decades if they had connections and money? Couldn't she have already skipped through?
I mean, I'm sure that must be, like you say, the Reddit sleuths, because she doesn't hint to that at all. She definitely hints to the idea in the piece that she would have never had access to this lifestyle or these places if it weren't for her husband.
But I wonder how much of that is a kind of artistic license or her lying to herself. I mean, I don't know. This is a problem. And I feel nervous every time that someone writes, and they're all invariably young women, writing these really personal essays. Because what's happened is that she has been trolled. People have been trying to find out everything about her. It's, so she's not even anonymous. That's her real name. She's got an Instagram. I was looking at her Instagram, which is now private. I don't know if it was before. But people are annihilating everything about her. The fact that on Reddit, people are discussing what her parents did and what she was like when she was younger. What are you getting out of this is what I want to know.
Well, she's getting an article published in New York Mag, I guess.
But
she's super passionate about being a writer, then that's a big professional tick for her. So maybe she just decided to go for it.
It's a professional tick, but I am so disillusioned with that kind of thing now. With this writer, I'd never heard of her before. I think that's reputationally damaging.
I agree, because now she's just the woman, the kept woman, whose husband facilitates her being able to write.
Yeah.
And it's like she's getting these bylines, not of her own merit, but because she's almost had help. I don't know. There's something a bit weird about it. It kind of tarnishes her own talent.
Exactly. And what might happen is, okay, you might get a flood of new followers for maybe 3 months whilst you're story is still going viral and interesting, but then what happens?
Well, it's kind of like her name escapes me now, but when we had Caroline Calloway on the podcast and we spoke about Natalie Beach, that's it, who'd written for The Cut, and then she got a whole book deal off the back of it, but actually the book was a flop.
Yeah, because no one really cared past that
viral essay.
Well, what they cared about was Caroline. But yes, I just think it's something that we often return to on this podcast, which is the commodification of personal trauma for what? For one byline that no one's going to remember in a year and like 400 quid. Like, genuinely, women, stop selling your lives. It's not worth it.
But it's so hard because we live in a society that encourages the commodification of the self at all costs.
Yeah. Everyone's a sellout now, as you said.
Okay.
God, it's actually depressed me a little bit.
I know what you mean.
I want to check, but basically what I want to do is in a year talk to Sophia Christie and be like, was it worth it?
I'd love that.
I think it's also something we spoke about in the Dolly Alderton episode. I think if it's a piece that genuinely really does good in terms of at a community level, whether that be busting a taboo or being able to communicate with women that maybe didn't feel seen or people, sorry, not just women. But I don't understand the greater good of this piece.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't feel like this is really
Why are you doing this to yourself kind of thing?
You're not going to find a community of kind of women being like, yes, thank God you said it. Like-minded gold diggers. Yeah. Finally, we feel seen and heard.
We're a marginalized group. Rich, young, beautiful women that don't have to work.
The intellectual gold diggers. We see you, Hans. Yeah.
Right. We want to give all of our fellow gym honeys a fabulous recommendation for a super healthy plant-based protein supplement that, unlike most of the other plant proteins out there, actually tastes bloody amazing, and we are obsessed.
We are. So I've been really interested in exploring protein full of actual nourishing ingredients this year, which is how I came across science-backed wellness brand Innermost, which focuses on making premium health supplements and is stocked everywhere from Ocado to John Lewis and Soho House.
Each of Innermost products are tailored to a specific goal, and we've both absolutely loved the health protein, which contains 31 grams of plant-based protein, which is actually much, much higher than most other plant protein brands, I'll have you know, plus lots of immune boosting mushrooms, which of course I love, including shiitake, maitake, reishi and cordyceps, and acai berries as a powerful antioxidant.
I am so fussy about how my protein tastes, so some of them can be really grainy and the taste can be really unpleasant, particularly with plant protein, but this one goes down such a treat. It comes in three simple flavors: chocolate, vanilla or strawberry. I have mine with oat milk and it is delish.
Each pouch lasts about a month and costs $29.95. You can see on Innermost's website all of the ingredients. And importantly, Innermost blends also have no additives or synthetic ingredients. They're low sugar, gluten-free. Essentially, it's all super natural, super gorgeous, just the way we like it.
Exactly. Go check them out, guys. Their whole range of products, including their protein powders, are at liveinnermost.com.
Okay, so to give her a little bit of grace, one thing that I did quite like was, but again, this is quite the internet, it is slightly the intellectualization of gold diggery, but when she talked about male timelines, I was nodding. She says that when we decided we wanted to be equal to men, we got on men's time. We worked when they worked, retired when they retired, had to squeeze pregnancy, children, menopause, somewhere possibly in the margins. I mean, I know that's stating the obvious, but it is true and it is annoying. And it's very much like Caroline Corrado Perez kind of argument even, isn't it? It makes me think of even when we worked in a male-dominated office wearing coats every day in the summer because it was so cold, because air conditioning is programmed to always suit the male body temperature, not women's. Like, it's stating the bleeding obvious, but she is right. I can see why now there's such a pushback to traditionalism and young women on TikTok saying that they want to embrace being a mother and they want to quit working forever and all they want to do is look after their husbands and children and cook and clean and, you know, look after the home. No wonder women feel like that.
Yeah.
When we're being shoehorned into this very unsuitable, grueling, punishing framework that wasn't built for us. You know, even in the terms of the working week, well, men, I think their like sort of cycle is daily, whereas women's, of course, is monthly. Our menstrual cycle massively dictates how we feel at any given point in the month, and yet no accommodation is made for that within the actual world. It is wild how much we've accommodated for men.
Totally.
Oh, maybe not even accommodated, how much we've like contorted and reshaped ourselves to fit around
them. Yes. Yes, it really reminds me of Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's little cameo, I guess, feature on Beyoncé's Flawless. So Beyoncé samples one of her TED Talks, I think, where she goes, "We teach girls to shrink themselves to make themselves smaller. We say to girls, you can have ambition, but not too much. You should aim to be successful, but not too successful. Otherwise, you will threaten the man." Blah, blah, blah. She goes on. That really reminds what you saying of women having to contort themselves.
Yes.
I always think of that speech.
So she wrote a feminist manifesto. You can read it. I have the book copy somewhere at home, actually.
Do you?
So I'll dig it out and give it to you because it's really short and it's called We Should All Be Feminists.
Right. I love her novels.
I am obsessed with Americano.
Yes,
it is in my top
same.
Five books of all time. I know that's quite an obvious thing to say, but my God, I love that book. It's, what, like 11 years old now, and still I would heartily recommend to any honeys who haven't read it.
And Purple Hibiscus.
Her debut novel.
Yeah.
Excellent. Loved. Also. But yeah, Americano, without a doubt.
Absolutely,
top five books
I agree.
Of all time. Love it.
One last thing I will say on this, actually, that I've just thought of, that I do think a lot of the hate for this piece, I think, is driven by women. And I wonder how much of it is driven by fear of women our age reading about, basically seeing proof of their worst fears, which is that there are these young women that seek out older men and get them. So I think this piece, as someone who's 31, did make me feel maybe scared and like, no, I don't want this to be a thing, because I'm like, oh.
And it is bizarre that the writer of that piece is like 4 years younger than us.
I know.
That feels very strange when she's some kind of kept married woman who floats around in the south of France between Miami and London.
But
how are you younger than me?
I know, it's mad. But I guess your worst fear is that some 22-year-old hussy is going to like steal your man. Well, it's not your worst fear, but I do think it is something that plays into the fears of a lot of women.
Yeah, I think it depends, because that's not a fear for me at all.
I just noticed that a lot of my male friends are dating quite young.
Yeah, they are. And I do very much agree with the line in the piece where she, the bit that you read right at the start, when she's like, sorry, progress, but older men do like these things. I mean, there's no two ways about it. Men like younger women. That's a fact.
Yeah. And some women like younger men.
But a lot of women like older men.
And younger men. I've got a friend who's dating a 26-year-old.
Well, I think we kind of put more importance on age than there actually is.
Yeah, it all depends.
Reality,
exactly.
As we've said many times in our age gap coverage, unless, of course, one of the parties is actually underage, then it's a completely different story.
But I love hearing about women who date across the age spectrum. I find it empowering, so long as it's legal.
Well, I also want to talk about another New York Magazine piece.
Go
this
on.
Week. I don't know if you saw it. It was actually published a couple of weeks ago now on the 25th of March. I meant to talk about it last week and I just totally forgot. But I have been fascinated by the massive 8,000 word deep dive by Kerry Howley into Andrew Huberman. Do you know who Andrew Huberman
yes,
is?
Yes, I read that with great interest. It took me a long time. I was shocked. So he's a neuroscientist.
Yep, Andrew Huberman is a leading neuroscientist. He's a neuroscience professor at Stanford. He's a lab director at Stanford Medical School. And he is probably the world's leading scientist in the public eye now, insofar as he is the host of the Huberman Lab podcast. It only launched in 2021, but it's already become one of the biggest podcasts in the world. It was, in fact, third biggest in the world for 2023 after Joe Rogan and Call Her Daddy. He has the craziest reach. I mean, I've always quite liked him. Like, I've dipped into episodes here and there. I follow him on Instagram. He has 6.2 million followers on Instagram and more than 5.29 subscribers on YouTube. He's a kind of wellness bro. He's a leading guy in this particular male self-improvement podcasting space that has become so preeminent over the last few years, but he does have the proper credentials, as I say, so he's taken incredibly seriously. So he leads a lab focused on neurobiology and ophthalmology. I'm going to butcher this now, but ophthalmology, it's like the eye, I think, because the New York Magazine piece talks about how much of what he did was to do with severing the optic nerves of mice and then seeing which grew back.
Okay.
So all of that is just to say that, of course, he comes from a very rigorously academic perspective. And what he's done really well with his podcast is not pander to audiences as if they're idiots that don't understand science. So he still very much uses a lot of scientific kind of language. And the experts that he has on are from across all different fields. I know one of his biggest episodes, and it actually came out in August 2022, but to this day, it was one of the biggest podcast episodes of last year in terms of numbers globally, was his deep dive into alcohol and the effect that it has on the brain, the body and all the rest of it. He's essentially all about optimization, self-optimization. How can you be the best version of yourself? How can you use neuroscience to become better, healthier, smarter, more productive? Much of his success, I guess, has been in the way that he has given this free scientific tool to millions of people so they can better understand their own minds. So it is a really incredible mission.
Definitely. And I think particularly during the pandemic, he gave people like a routine.
Well, he only launched the podcast in 2021. Oh, I see. Yeah, so prior to that, he had been, so in 2016, he became a full-time professor at Stanford, where he now leads the lab that I mentioned about. And it was January 2021 that he launched his own podcast focused on actionable science. He, prior to that, had kind of made waves only in 2020 as a public figure by uploading videos to his own Instagram, where he would break down complex scientific ideas with diagrams and stuff like that.
I also read, I think it's in the piece that we're talking about, where the writer says that one of the reasons why he's so popular is because he doesn't condescend. Like he,
Though
he breaks stuff down, he actually won't do it in kind of like bite-sized for idiots kind of stuff. He will use complex words.
Yeah, he uses all the proper scientific terminology to describe things. So for those that haven't seen it, the piece is titled Andrew Huberman's Mechanisms of Control, The Private and Public Seductions of the World's Biggest Pop Neuroscientist. Prior to seeing this piece, all I had kind of taken in about Andrew Huberman was incredibly positive. I am quite into health optimization podcasts.
Yes.
I mean, it's not something I'd necessarily want to listen to every week, but I found it fascinating because the thing with Andrew Huberman, by the way, guys, if you don't know, do a little Google, have a look. He's 48 years old. He's a big old like
hunk.
Exactly. He's super muscular. He's got a big six pack. He's covered in tattoos. He's very serious. He's very formal in his delivery. You know, he is a proper personality. There's a cult of personality going on with him, and you can totally see why people have become so obsessed with him.
So what the piece reveals in the most fascinating way is that he had six concurrent girlfriends, at least that we know of. And in a classic kind of Tinder swindler manner, the girlfriends formed a WhatsApp group and took him down, except they haven't really taken him down because actually he's fine. But it's that classic thing of women coming together to like sleuth around the man that they share.
Exactly. So the piece opens with Sarah, which is a pseudonym actually, but the real identity of the woman has been revealed. Anyway, what this piece posits is that Sarah was his kind of long-term girlfriend. And while they were together, he had five affairs. And there was also another six women involved whose identity they've never been able to get to the bottom of. She actually once turned up at Andrew's house and saw him on the sofa with this woman.
Yes.
That was the six
women. And she was like, if you want to have an affair, do not have glass walls.
Yeah. So all this to say is that while the piece doesn't, of course, accuse Andrew of doing anything illegal or anything like that, it is definitely painting a picture of the self-styled Mr. Perfect being quite morally compromised. For someone that claims to be obsessed with self-optimization, being the best version of himself, he's also very into therapy speak.
Like many very intelligent men, he is an arch manipulator, is the impression I got.
Well, that's what I found quite fascinating about this. It's just that whenever you have these massive, larger-than-life figures that become famous, there is a dark side. There just always is. This just doesn't surprise me at all in a way, because someone as successful as him always has something weird going on in their personal life. Do you know what I mean?
To me, it's deeply tragic that you need so much stimulation and external validation that you need to have six women on the go.
And I think what the feature does is it exposes just how he kind of sought to control and mislead the partners.
Yes, I think for him, it wasn't even about sex. I think you're right. It was about the power trip he got from controlling these women. And also what's really interesting in the piece is that these women all turn out to be highly successful and smart.
He had a type.
Yes, and I do think you have to be careful with saying that certain affairs are more galling because the woman was smart and successful.
Oh, obviously. I don't think they're more galling than
that. But I think the piece does make a point of the fact that it was interesting that he managed to dupe such powerful women.
But I think what they're actually getting at there, though, is, again, his kind of public versus private persona. When he's on air, he's very concerned with how patriarchy can be problematic and have, like, deep psychological impact. And yet, in his personal life, he says that he wants a woman who is submissive, who he can smack on the ass in the streets and stuff. Well, that does not marry up.
No. Is it Sarah, the first woman that that the piece leads with, where they describe how her friends were like, she changed so much. She was so independent and she was so feisty and she became really submissive. I was like, I just want to cook for my man.
And I had to always apologize to him. He was fixated on the fact that she had two children from a previous relationship. He at one point said that being with her was like bobbing for apples in feces. It was all this very like subtle mind game. So a quote that I liked was, Huberman sells a dream of control down to the cellular level, but something has gone wrong. In the midst of immense fame, a chasm has opened up between the podcaster preaching dopaminergic restraint and a man with newfound wealth with access into a world unseen by most professors. The problem with a man always working on himself is that he may also be working on you.
Mm.
And I think that line gets to the nuts and bolts
of
it. He would claim to all of these women that he was almost just this messianic, like better than them, genius figure who had understood or cracked the code to life and therefore was going to help them work on themselves and guide them through almost like therapeutically becoming better. And yet he's slightly full of shit.
In terms of what he was getting out of it, do you think he was actually just really attracted to these smart, successful, independent women and he wanted to be around them and have sex with them because that's who he lusts after? And then he manipulated them because that's just his character. Or do you think for him the game was he loved subjugating
powerful
women?
Well, there's a few quotes on this that I thought were interesting. Like, as I said, on air, he would kind of claim to be concerned about patriarchal conditioning. And yet the piece says that multiple women recall him saying he preferred the kind of relationship in which the woman was monogamous, but the man was not. He told me, says Mary being one of the women that he was seeing behind Sarah's back. And also, in a way, he was seeing the other women behind her back too.
Yeah.
So by the way, Andrew Huberman's spokesperson has come back on like a lot of the claims in the piece.
I found those
very
disturbing.
Odd. And one of them being, So Sarah says that she and Andrew were so serious that they'd embarked on IVF together. Well, one thing I found quite odd that's almost a side note in the piece is that it suggests that they were doing IVF because that was like another form of control for Andrew rather than trying naturally to conceive. So anyway, they started IVF. It actually failed. They had like four attempts, but Andrew's spokesperson, coming back to this piece, said, no, they weren't trying to have children. They simply were creating embryos. Well, I'm sorry. If you're creating embryos with someone, what else is the goal?
God, this reminds me of a piece that I really want to talk about next week. I'm not going to go into it now, but there's a whole piece, I think also in the cut or something, about men who control women through freezing embryos with them and then like not allowing them to use them and leaving them and then not allowing them to use them. It's like a thing.
Yeah. So there's obviously a very kind of,
again, control.
Dark, problematic kind of element to that. Apparently, Andrew told one of the women that he wasn't a sex addict, he was a love addict. So addiction, Huberman says, is a progressing narrowing of things that bring you joy. In August 2021, in the same month that Sarah first learned of Andrew's cheating, so she looked in his journal and saw something about cheating, and then there was another
Why
time.
Would you write that you cheated in your diary and then leave it out?
But he was like, I'm sorry you feel that way. Like, he'll just therapy speak all these women into submission. And he'd be like, I hear you and I understand your feelings. And he did an episode, which was huge, actually. I really liked it, with Anna Lemke, who's the chief of Stanford Addiction Medicine Dual Diagnostic Clinic. She's like a leading expert scientist on dopamine. She wrote the book called Dopamine Nation. And she gives a very clear explanation of why dopamine causes addiction. And so he then playfully says, oh, Dr. Anna's just diagnosed me on air, but frames it that he's actually addicted with work. So he says, I'm work addicted. And she says, well, isn't it good that your addiction is something that can be so positive for so many people?
If only she knew.
So, by the way, side note, guys, if you're interested in dopamine, I am very interested in dopamine and how it drives like everything that we do as human beings, then I really recommend Dr. Daniel Z. Lieberman's book, The Molecule of More.
Ooh, do you have it?
I do at home. I'll give it to you if you like.
Will you kindly?
Yeah. Guys, we've said this before, but when it comes to our podcast partners, they really are an authentic recommendation from us to you. We genuinely wouldn't tell you to buy anything that we wouldn't tell our IRL friends to, which is why we are over the moon to be partnering yet again with our favourite adaptogenic coffee brand, London Nootropics.
Yes, and of course, we are armed with a juicy 20% discount code again. So just enter straight up, all one word, no caps, at the checkout at londonnootropics.com. We'll also put it in the show notes. And if you needed just a teeny bit more persuading on how and why adaptogenic coffee will completely change your day, then listen up.
Okay, so adaptogens are fungi and natural plant extracts that clinical studies have proven to have incredible effects on our well-being, from reducing anxiety to boosting energy and your immune system. Els and I have been converts for about a year now. We are obsessed. We drink one or two of Nootropics' three adaptogenic coffee blends every day, depending on whether we're wanting to feel super focused at work, tackle stress, or just go and do some exercise.
Exactly. So I start most mornings with the Mojo blend before heading to the gym. It's made with cordyceps mushroom, known to increase aerobic capacity and oxygen flow. So it naturally boosts strength, physical endurance and ATP, which, fun fact, is our energy molecule. It's actually a way healthier pre-workout than your average pre-workout supplement, which contains way too much caffeine and sweetness.
God, yes, they make me feel so jittery. I do not like those. Nootropics, on the other hand, are top stuff, thanks to being so rich in active compounds, a marker of quality in adaptogens, by the way, all of which are listed on the Nootropics website, so you know exactly what you're putting in your body. I must say also that Mojo is perfect for anyone battling with a bit of jet lag.
So true. And if you're worried about adaptogens tasting a little funky, do not worry. These blends, all freshly packaged in gorgeous individual sachets, taste fab. So head to londonnootropics.com and enter the code straight up at the checkout for that 20% off. That's straight up, all one word, no caps. Enjoy, guys.
I think what I found really interesting about the piece, beyond the kind of moral quandaries it brings up in terms of whether people that do morally unsavory things in their personal lives should be kind of published in the public forum, you know, is his podcast any less just because he cheated on his girlfriend? Well, not necessarily. I'm not saying that. But it is fascinating how these larger than life personalities can essentially manipulate not only the people around them, but also even their own origin stories. So he's very much a, yes, exactly that. He's like a self-built man.
So true.
And much of what he says about the past, you know, can't even be, you know, verified by the New York Magazine. So for example, he talks about his childhood being one of neglect, essentially, after his parents divorced. So he says he essentially had a lovely childhood till his parents divorced, and then they neglected him and he went off the rails, and he claims that he spent a month in a youth detention center. Well, the New York Magazine article kind of casts aspersion on that, doesn't it? It hints that they couldn't find any record of this particular detention center he mentions. They speak to previous peers at school who say they don't remember him being troubled. His parents deny his assertion of neglect. They say he was a little bit troubled, but nothing super serious. Classmates don't recall the street fights that he's mentioned. So it is quite fascinating to see how much of the Andrew Huberman that I've always taken as just at his word is perhaps a bit of a Great Gatsby.
And do you know what that really reminds me of that I know will really interest you? And I'm no doubt you've read this piece. The Jay Shetty expose.
Yes. Oh my God.
Where again, he created his own origin story.
So I haven't read that piece, but I've seen the woman, the previous partner behind the piece, do a TikTok about it.
Yes, she did a viral TikTok. Yeah. But read the Guardian piece, guys. We'll put it in the show notes. And by the way, guys, we hear you. We did receive some feedback that we don't do enough. Links in the show notes. We will do more. But this is called Uncovering the Higher Truth of Jay Shetty in The Guardian by John McDermott. Went live end of Feb. And Mike, and exactly what you're saying, just like Andrew Huberman, it turns out he made a lot of shit up about his origin story.
Yes. K Kerry Howley, writer of the New York Mag piece, even questions Huberman's kind of Stanford credentials. So not that she says he's not a neuroscientist or anything like that, but she kind of talks about how Huberman Lab, the podcast, is premised on the image of a working scientist. So you imagine these clean white counters, rodents in cages, postdoctorates peering into microscopes. But apparently, according to their research, it's barely a lab. So they spoke to a Stanford researcher and they said that it's reportedly no more than one postdoctoral student working alone. Plus, of course, Andrew does live miles away from Stanford in Topanga, which is just by LA. So apparently when he decided he wanted to kind of become famous from 2020 onward, he hired a photographer who was known for working with DC, the shoe brand, and was like a cool skate brand so that he could kind of, you know, make sure he was presenting his cool scientist image in the appropriate way.
What I found really interesting about that piece was that some women have chosen to remain in contact with him because he's just such a brilliant mind that they're willing to forgive all of this.
But that is what I did find, I guess, nuanced about the piece, is that they don't just levy these accusations and then say, what a terrible man, here's the end. Actually, they speak to several former partners that all claim that he has a very good heart, that yes, he might have had troubles with anger or he might have been a little bit unreliable, but, you know, essentially he's a very good man and they're all still great friends with him. So I don't think this piece posits that Andrew Huberman is an absolute monster. It's a lot thornier than that. So it's divided people. But I think for the most part, people were still going on to love him. So I don't know if you noticed in the piece as well, but they talk about his fan base. You know, there's the Huberman husbands, which are like his male fans. But then there's also a massive trend on TikTok, which is Daddy Huberman. So women love him too. I don't think suddenly he's going to become a kind of
pariah.
Yeah, among female listeners. I think it's going to be a lot more complicated than that.
I mean, I've never listened to his podcast, but it makes me want to listen to it now because I'm like, I just want to psychoanalyze you on it.
I think you'd find it boring.
Would I?
Yeah, it's pure science, health stuff. It's so not you at all. It's about how like looking at daylight in the morning is going to improve your circadian rhythms. It's just the kind of stuff that I'm kind of interested in that you really turn off that.
Okay, fine.
Yes.
Then I shall give it a giant swerve. And
do have a look at his Instagram though.
I'll have a look at his Instagram.
This probably is problematic for me to say, but he is an attractive man. You can absolutely see where the Daddy Huberman trend has come from.
So, sorry to be really crass, but yeah, so I was having a look at the Google imagery around him. And there is the hunky Huberman, where he looks kind of Viking-like, which is actually, I don't find attractive. Then there's a kind of more attractive guy called Andrew Huberman, who can't be the same Andrew Huberman.
Well, shame.
But then he is. But no, that is him. But he looks so much more attractive in this kind of less hunky version of him.
Gosh, yeah, that's because he's got no facial hair.
Talking of hunks, I want to talk about a Vulture piece about hunks.
God, we're really on the American New York Mag, the cut Vulture hype this week. By the way, if you want to go and read the Huberman piece and you can't get behind the paywall, just pay the $1 free trial. It's well worth it. I'm going to cancel mine, but I've been loving having a peruse around all of the Vulture cut New York Mag pieces.
I'd say a dollar is well worth 8,000 words of investigative journalism. Guys, support journalists and support this piece as well, which is called The Hunks Du Jour. I need to start having fun on Instagram again.
Go on then.
So the writer, so it's a very tongue-in-cheek piece, but she says, the hunk posting strategy is getting dire. The hunks are not posting themselves. In fact, they're barely even posting at all. A decade ago, a hunky up-and-coming actor would have a thotty dub smash account. I actually don't know what that is. Or a boy band was contractually obligated by Simon Cowell to do video diaries. Though they may not seem like it now, hunks used to post. They used to show us their friends. They used to do travel photo dumps and they used to post unflattering gym selfies. Can't some of them at least do a casual photo dump? Spawn.
Who are the hunks she's talking about?
She categorises them. So she says the analogue photographers are Paul Mescal and Josh O'Connor.
Photographers?
Yeah, so their Instagram is instead of thirst traps, just like arty pictures of them always behind the camera. So Paul Mescal, for instance, his enduring appeal is his commitment to his friends and family as evidenced in his mostly quiet Instagram where he shares photos he takes with the people he loves. And then there's the publicist where there's just people posting like promo shots. So Nicholas Gallant scene, which we need to talk about in our next episode because the idea of you, which is all about fan fiction, it was a piece of fan fiction about Harry Styles that's got turned into a film starring Anne Hathaway.
Ooh. And is that why that film's getting so much buzz?
Yeah.
Right. I was getting confused as to why this new Anne Hathaway film is being so hyped. And it's because it's in fact about Harry Styles. That makes more sense.
I think the fan fiction was about Harry Styles. Yeah. And it's also just mad that fan fiction is becoming like bought by studios now. It's like valid IP to turn into stories. And yeah, Anne Hathaway plays like an older woman who falls in love with a young pop star.
So that's the star of that film.
So she's categorized in The Publicist. So it's just endless press shots, yeah, or like, here's my film poster. Also under The Publicist is Harry Styles. She says, Styles has been one of the most boring people to follow on Instagram for a while.
He's been like, he's always been boring to follow on Instagram. I'm sorry, I actually find this stating the bleeding obvious.
Jeremy Allen White, again, just promo only. Jacob Elordi, absolutely nothing, just completely dark. Yeah. Harris Dickinson, fun, zany selfies, which is what we like to see.
I don't even know who Harris Dickinson is.
He was the main guy in Triangle of Sadness.
Yes. Okay. But that's slightly more niche than being Harry Styles. You know, you can get away with posting your own personal shots a little bit more. You're not quite under the microscope to the same degree.
True. Joe Alwyn apparently does a good combination of press photos and memes in the odd casual photo dump. So he gets a mini gold star. However, the ones that do well are Barry Keoghan. Obviously, he actually can't get enough of himself. Timothy Chalamet.
But always. He's really quiet with posting sometimes, and then other times, I would say he's one of the PR ones.
What, Barry Keoghan?
No, Timothy Chalamet.
Oh, Barry Keoghan, I think, actually did a candid shot from him in the sauna topless.
Barry
Keoghan's
gone overkill. Lots of my friends have even been saying that to me, like, in the WhatsApp groups and stuff. Everyone's like, can you stop now? These shoots are getting too much. They're not edgy. They're not cool. You need to rein it in.
Actually, I saw a piece that was like, we need to stop objectifying Barry Keoghan.
Yeah, and it kind of goes back to the thing that happened with Pedro Pascal on the red carpet.
Yes,
about
he got
being
really
daddy
upset.
Where they asked him to constantly read all these like thirst messages. I do think it's pretty problematic. We can't ask for women not to be sexualized or objectified at every turn, but then just do it to men constantly as and when we feel like. That's just not the way the cookie crumbles.
I actually do really agree with that. But it actually reminds me of a Bustle piece I read recently where someone was quoted saying it's kind of a thrill to objectify men because of the way that women have been objectified for such a long time. However, I would say I would agree with you that I think we've done that now and now we need to redress the balance again.
Definitely.
I think we've had both extremes.
And I don't think it's particularly helpful to be talking about how men ought to objectify themselves online. I don't know. Something about that just doesn't sit right with me. Even though I love the idea of the Instagram hug and I'm happy to, you know, chat about what people look like. I don't know. There's something about that feels a bit icky.
I think sometimes Vulture and The Cut in particular get their like chatty, conversational, let's talk to our readers like we're just friends over a cocktail bar. I think they sometimes get it a bit too wrong and they go too intimate and too inappropriate. I am noticing that.
That said, I do love their social media person.
But they're so anti Meghan and Harry. I'm seeing loads of pushback to their like constant anti Meghan propaganda.
I always thought they were pro Meghan and Harry. God.
No, they're really bitchy about Meghan on The Cut social.
Because of the new brand.
And they get real shit about it from their readers, being like, is this the Daily Mail? Sorry.
But I do love the little fun like celebrity insights that they share. So I was very excited the other day to see that Rosalia and Hunter Schaefer, in fact, used to be an item.
I loved that piece of gossip which you told me.
Yeah, who knew?
Beautiful.
I mean, I just love them both.
Actually, talking of Hunter Schaefer, I read a really good interview with her in GQ. It was interesting because she was talking about her experience being trans and being a trans spokesperson, but also being sick of talking about being trans. And she was like, actually, yeah, I can do more as an activist by not talking about it and just being an amazing
being authentically actress. Herself and showing up in the world.
Exactly, which I really do understand. That it was that classic thing of, even though she keeps saying this to the journalist just keeps talking about having trans, you know, and the journalist is like, yes, and she just wants to stop talking about it now. And then the next paragraph is about her being trans again.
Yeah.
But there was a really beautiful quote that I think she gave about spiritualism between trans people, which I want to read out. She said that she thinks of transgender in terms of mother nature. There have been trans people for so long and they keep making more of us. So there's something there. There is something there. I think there's something kind of cosmic and mystical about that. When I look at other trans people's art, there's this frequency, this kind of common thread, whether it's a sound or an aesthetic that's consistent. I think it's probably yielded from the shared experience that we all have that's very unique. There's something very spiritual about it and kind of magical.
I love that.
Because she does a lot of
Hunter
art herself.
Hunter is very magical.
Yes.
Her outfit at the Vanity Fair Oscars party, whoo, that was my absolute favourite look. She looked like an ethereal queen.
Yeah, she looks amazing. And apparently she's a really amazing artist.
Oh, I'll have to go and have a look at some of her work.
But I thought that was just a really beautiful quote.
Yeah, I love that. I love her. Excellent stuff. Right, honey, to finish, I want to very quickly tell you about Miss Me, the new podcast from Lily Allen and Makita Oliver.
Yeah.
I have gone away to listen so that I can give you and the honeys the update, the debrief. I like it. I think it's really fun. I wasn't sure what to expect. So there's two episodes a week and they're split into a general chat plus a topical episode called Listen Bitch. For example, the last two topics on Listen Bitch have been lying and then virginity. The lying one was called the kleptomania years and they spoke very amusingly about, because Makita and Lilia are lifelong friends. They've been friends since they were born.
Yeah.
So they talked about quite a funny period they both had as teenagers, kept nicking stuff. But the virginity episode as well, I also thought you'd definitely like. Because Lily basically talks about how she doesn't even like the topic of virginity because she thinks it's a patriarchal construct. And actually, we should be focused on your first positive experience rather than the first time you ever engage in the act. Because actually talking about people losing their virginity, for one, doesn't account for the many people whose first experience was quite terrible.
Mm.
And it almost puts too much importance on it. But also she talks about the actual language. She says, when do you ever hear something being lost as a positive?
That's true.
Yeah. I really liked it. I have to say the topical episodes, the Listen Bitch episodes, so the virginity one, the lying one, are my preferred format, I think, to the general chat. They talk about different cultural things. Lily's comments on Beyonce. By the way, I can't believe we didn't discuss.
No, I know. Favourite song?
Last week.
Mine's Bodyguard.
Is it? Yes, that's probably mine. And I love the Miley Cyrus Two Most Wanted duet. And yeah, I loved Dolly Parton's little response. You
Dolly
know, the kind of voice note thing she does before the cover of Jolene. I just thought that was quite iconic.
Hey, honey bee, it's Dolly
But Lily has made headlines because she spoke about the fact that she thought that Beyonce doing a country album was a calculated move. I mean, the Daily Mail had gone ham on the coverage of this and made it sound like Lily was like bashing Beyonce, which, to be fair, I wouldn't say she was really bashing her. I would say it was just a kind of interesting perspective. It was quite funny though, because Lily was saying all of this being in literally recording from Nashville herself, where she was doing her album. But she argues that Beyonce doing a country album is a calculated move, perhaps to kind of try and take on Taylor Swift.
Well, so, there is a huge untapped audience in country
music. So she's like, I wonder if she essentially looked at Taylor Swift and was like, she's doing really well and is the most successful female artist of all time. Maybe I need to come for that audience too.
And maybe she wants the Album of the Year Grammy.
And she argued that the moment at the Grammys where Jay-Z complained about, you know, even by your own metrics, this doesn't make sense. So guys, if you don't know, Jay-Z got up at the Grammys and complained about the fact that despite being, I think, the most awarded artist of all time.
I think she's had 26 Grammys.
Beyonce has never won Album of the Year. But while he was saying all this, Beyonce was sat there wearing the blonde wig and the cowboy hat. So Lily Allen argued that she took that to mean that that moment was part of the promo for this record.
Okay, but I think that lots of artists do that.
Yeah, I don't think but this is the thing, to be fair, the Daily Mail have made it sound as if Lily is ripping her to shreds, as I say, whereas it was like a passing comment that I actually found to be the most interesting cultural commentary of the episode. Because, you know, they're not coming in with five recommendations each. They're like loosely referring to a book they might have picked up or the biggest album of the bloody year so far in the moment.
I do like hearing celebrities being honest about other celebrities, because usually it's just massive arse-licking and no one says anything candid.
Exactly. So yeah, I would say definitely have a listen. They're bloody open. Like, my goodness, the virginity episode, they both get into like the stories.
When did they
of how
lose
they...
their virginities? Or when did they gain their sexual experience?
Well, so Lily says she's not sure which time she lost virginity. She recalls two occasions. One being when she was very young and she was on holiday with her dad and her brother Alfie Allen in Brazil. And she got together with a man called Fernando. She was about 14 and he was in his early 20s.
Oh my God.
So she mentions that, but then she says there was also a time, and she's not sure which was first, where she was in, I think she says it was in like a,
isn't that statutory rape?
Yeah. Again, this is kind of Lily's point, I think. She's like, I actually don't even want to think about how traumatic most of my experiences were at that age and with sex. Mm. And actually, I'd much rather focus on the first time I made myself orgasm. Why can't that be the focus instead of when a man took your virginity, is kind of her argument.
Right, yeah.
But the other time was, in above a shop on the Finchley Road with a guy from her school called Milo.
Okay.
Which I was like, is that, I think that wasn't quite his name, but I was like, interesting choice to literally share his identity.
Yes. But maybe it was a pseudonym.
They're really fearless in how much they share. And actually, even though Makita's recording from London and Lily's in the US, you do not get the sense that they're not in the same room.
Because they're both such big personalities.
Yeah, and because they have so much shared history. I think that makes it really work.
Really warm,
and they're quite like hilariously, you know, like critical of each other, but in a loving way. So actually, I have to say, when we just started the podcast, it made me think that because Lily changes her voice from one episode to the next. And Makita's like, why is your voice sounding like that? And Lily was like, because I was listening to some episodes back and I felt that my voice sounded a bit squawking, so I'm trying this new thing. And Makita's like, yeah, I can hear you trying the dulcet tones. Stop it.
Stop it.
Why are you putting on a voice? Don't do that. It's just really funny. Like, their dynamic together is lovely.
We feel
what's
that.
Also really interesting is loads of the listener messages that they play are from Americans. So I think because of Lily's marriage to David Harbour, she's become even more of a name in the US.
God, I was looking at pictures of their Brooklyn apartment the other day. Did you see those?
Stunning in Architectural Digest.
Yeah. I want to discuss on that note of virginities, Rebel Wilson.
Oh my God, yes.
Lost her
I'm
at
so
35.
Glad you're bringing up that side note because
okay,
that has been quite
let's
funny.
Let's be real. 35.
I've never... Hey, no shame if you are 35. I think great, as she said for her, that she's brought this up so that people don't feel insecure about what age they lost their virginity. But 35 is quite old.
Yes, I think I've never heard that before. But also, I bet there are loads of women that wait that long. Maybe it's not even that long. Do you want to say, I wish, actually, I don't really want to talk about my virginity. Sorry.
Well, exactly. I was thinking, listening to Lily and Makita, like, wow, this is not a topic that I'd want to pick for the podcast.
I was suddenly like, I need to be this. Guys, one thing for me as a massive oversharer is not oversharing on the podcast. So let me put a pin
rail
on that.
Rail that back.
Let me, because I would have genuinely just gone on a massive storytelling.
When you first lost your virginity.
It's a good one.
Again, your mum will probably listen. So
oh
let's
my
bear
good
that in
God
mind.
I am actually still a virgin. But I think it's great that Rebel felt like normalizing
it. Yes, I think it's actually really powerful. I also have not been able to take my eyes away from the revelation that the previously unnamed man who essentially assaulted her on set of a film was in fact Sacha Baron Cohen.
Allegedly.
Yes. He's strenuously denied this, by the way.
Yes.
But it was allegedly on the set of Grimsby, which I always hated, by the way. So Sacha Baron Cohen had such a moment when we were young. Like, people loved Ali G, and then there was Bruno, and then Grimsby I always found weird, but now when I actually look back, I really see what a deeply problematic person he is. So many of his jokes were actually like really rooted in Islamophobia. I feel like he's clearly a despicable person.
My one experience of Sacha Baron Cohen, personal experience, is at the GQ Men of the Year Awards. And I remember, because a lot of men were dicks that night, as we've spoken about.
As we've covered.
But he was really charming, so, as was Isla Fisher.
I also do remember they had to literally, I think, make him sign a contract, which was unheard of. Don't know if I should be spilling these Men of the Year
go
secrets.
On, babe.
But they literally made him promise before the awards that he wasn't going to like do anything to fuck it up.
That's so funny.
Yeah, because they were so concerned, because it was the year that Prince Charles was there, then Prince, obviously he's now king, but there was, of course,
real
I'm the
jeopardy
royal member of the family there.
Oh my
that was
God
massive. Like, the security and everything was so crazy. If Sacha Baron Cohen had done a single thing to fuck it up, like, that would have been a catastrophe. And of course, they'd been burnt. It was actually my first ever Men of the Year. I was interning in the PR department. I want to say it was literally like 2012, 2013, something like that. And Russell Brand.
Yes. We didn't share this in the Russell Brand episode.
Massively, massively pissed off, like, literally everyone, but particularly the lead sponsor of Men of the Year, which is Hugo Boss. So bear in mind that they are literally financing this entire very bougie event. And Russell Brand gets on stage and makes a quip about how Hugo Boss used to outfit the Nazis.
Which they did.
Which they did. But obviously that's not something that is necessarily a great PR moment for them, which is the entire purpose of them doing the awards, is for it to be a great PR moment. And he literally did like a salute and everything on stage.
Oh my God.
It was honestly like a car crash. And I remember, again, being in the PR department, having quite an interesting kind of perspective on it or insight, when the next day, the previous events director at GQ was, of course, freaking out. And she had come in and said that they basically insisted that every single magazine cover that had Russell Brand on it, because they would do multiple Men of the Year covers, by the way, so different winners would feature on different covers, and they insisted that all the Russell Brand covers got pulled because they were so pissed off. They didn't want a single Russell Brand cover getting out there. Some did. They got out at the airport because those issues were sent earlier.
Did they like sell for like £20?
Well, they were literally trying. I think they were like literally trying to stop the delivery bands from like getting to WH Smith to put these magazines on shelves, kind of thing.
That is so funny.
But yeah, so they were really worried about Sacha Baron Cohen.
And
to go back
also
to
the Russell Brand night, I remember he had to be chucked out of the after party, didn't he?
Well, yeah, they were super pissed off with him because of the whole thing. So they chucked him out for that reason.
But there was also another reason.
Oh, he was snogging Jemima Khan or something, wasn't he?
He was something, he had like Jemima Khan on the table or something.
Yeah. And I think she was married at the time.
Was she? Oh my God.
There was some very kind of odd, don't quote us allegedly. On that, guys. Allegedly. But back to Sacha Baron Cohen, he and Isla Fisher's divorce announcement this week was rather odd, wasn't it? In their tennis clothing. I mean, I can only assume that that picture was taken ages ago and they chose to use it to try and do their tongue-in-cheek, like, our longest tennis match of 20 years is now over, or 12 years, whatever it was. But surely you wouldn't dress up as tennis players to announce your separation.
But it's not because of the... It's not because Rebel Wilson accused him of... Oh, so we should also say what she accused him of.
Yes, sorry, guys. So as I mentioned previously, there was a chapter in Rebel Wilson's memoir which alleged that a unnamed star had assaulted her on set of a film that she'd been in. That person has been revealed to be Sacha Baron Cohen on the set of Grimsby.
Yes, allegedly.
And Sacha Baron Cohen denies this.
Yes. So she said... It felt like every time I'd speak to SBC, he'd mention that he wanted me to go naked in a future scene. I was like, ha, I don't do nudity, Sasha. Rebel then claimed that she was summoned by a product assistant for an additional scene while shooting in Cape Town, South Africa. So then Sacha Baron Cohen, in a room, which was apparently with none of like the crew and just his mates, pulls his pants down very matter-of-factly and says, okay, now I want you to stick your finger up my ass. And I'm like, what? No.
Oh, my God, I mean, I just can't believe that he was ever the man of the moment. When I look back, as I say, on all of his comedy, I'm like, his jokes were always at the expense of others.
Yes, I do think there's something quite sick of thriving off the discomfort of others. However, I will say that one really good, I don't really like any of his comedy, to be fair, but one show I did really like that he was in was The Spy on Netflix. Did you ever watch that?
Oh, I hated that with a did deep you? Passion. Basically, I just started to massively hate his entire output.
So you just couldn't watch
Bruno, and I found everything that he did to suddenly be so offensive. Yeah, so it wouldn't surprise me at all that he was the previously unnamed star in Rebel Wilson's book. And apparently, the reason that Isla Fisher has actually pushed for them to announce that they separated last year now is because of how embarrassed she is, allegedly, the kind of furore around Rebel's allegations. She wants to distance herself from him, and they did separate last year, so that's why they've made the announcement now. Again, kind of like Huberman, another very successful, super prominent man that's actually not the flipping god that they've been treated as for so long.
Well, talking of charming, successful, fiercely intelligent, duplicitous men, I am going to watch the new Ripley series on Netflix.
I'm intrigued because I've seen the first episode and I'm not going to say anything about it right now, but I would love to debrief next week.
I can deduce from your facial expressions what you think.
Well, what I will say is that it's a 5-star review in The Guardian and was called spellbinding.
Our favourite word. Well, you should read the 2-star review in The Telegraph.
Okay. So there is mixed reviews. Yeah. Well, we'll get into it next week. You know, we love a bit of Andrew Scott.
We do love a bit of Andrew Scott.
I should say, as I didn't actually put a kind of full stop at the end of that last recommendation, do go and listen to Miss Me by Lily Allen and Mickey Taylor.
Oh, yes.
It's a fun podcast. It's a BBC Sounds podcast, but it's available in all like the usual places. As I say, just don't be expecting too much culture. Go for the fun childhood stories.
And certainly also come back to us when you're done listening to them.
Do not replace your weekly straight up slot with Miss Me, whatever you do.
No, because it's not that good.
No, it's not that good. No. God, just saying.
Who is, really, frankly? Right then, we need to go and just...
Live our lives. Guys, you do the same. Go live your life for the next week and we will reconvene back here, same time, same place, next week.
Leave us a review on Apple, vote in our Spotify poll and do send us a DM at Straight Up Pod.
Love you, honeys.